From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Hot Eyes, Cold Eyes by Lawrence Block. Some days were easy. She would go to work and return home without once feeling the invasion of men's eyes. She might take her lunch and eat in the park. She might stop on the way home at the library for a book, at the deli for barbecued chicken, at the cleaners, at the drugstore. On those days, she could move coolly and crisply through space and time, untouched by the stares of men. Doubtless, they looked at her on those days, as on the more difficult days. She was the sort men looked at, and she had learned that early on, when her legs first began to lengthen and take shape, when her breasts began to bud. Later, as the legs grew longer and the breasts fuller, and as her face lost its youthful plumpness and was sculpted by time into beauty, the stares increased. She was attractive. She was beautiful. She was, curious phrase, easy on the eyes. So men looked at her, and on the easy days she didn't seem to notice, didn't let their rude stares penetrate the invisible shield that guarded her. But this was not one of those days. It started in the morning. She was waiting for the bus when she first felt the heat of a man's eyes upon her. At first she willed herself to ignore the feeling, wished the bus would come and whisk her away from it, but the bus did not come, and she could not ignore what she felt, and inevitably she turned from the street to look at the source of the feeling. There was a man leaning against a red brick building, not 20 yards from her. He was perhaps 35, unshaven, and his clothes looked as though he'd slept in them. When she turned to glance at him, his lips curled slightly, and his eyes, red-rimmed and glassy, moved first to her face, then drifted insolently the length of her body. She could feel their heat. It leaped from the eyes to her breast and loins like an electric charge, bridging a gap. He placed his hand deliberately upon his crotch and rubbed himself. His smile widened. She turned from him, drew a breath, let it out, wished the bus would come. Even now, with her back to him, she could feel the embrace of his eyes. They were like hot hands upon her buttocks and the back of her thighs. The bus came, neither early nor late, and she mounted the steps and dropped her fare in the box. The usual driver, a middle-aged fatherly type, gave her his usual smile and wished her the usual good morning. His eyes were an innocent watery blue behind thick-lens spectacles. Was it only her imagination that his eyes swept her body all the while? But she could feel them on her breast, could feel, too, her own nipples hardening in response to their palpable touch. She walked the length of the aisle to the first available seat. Male eyes tracked her every step of the way. The day went on like that. This did not surprise her, although she had hoped it would be otherwise, had prayed during the bus ride that eyes would cease to bother her when she left the bus. She had learned, though, that once a day began in this fashion, its pattern was set, unchangeable. Was it something she did? Did she invite their hungry stares? She certainly didn't do anything with the intention of provoking male lust. Her dress was conservative enough, her makeup subtle and unremarkable. Did she swing her hips when she walked? Did she wet her lips and pout like a sullen sex pot? She was positive she did nothing of the sort, and it often seemed to her that she could cloak herself in a nun's habit, and the results would be the same. Men's eyes would lift the black skirt and strip away the veil. At the office building where she worked, the elevator starter glanced at her legs, then favored her with a knowing wet-lipped smile. One of the office boys, a rabbity youth with unfortunate skin, stared at her breasts, then flushed scarlet when she caught him at it. Two older men gazed at her from the water cooler. One leaned over to murmur something to the other. They both chuckled and went on looking at her. She went to her desk and tried to concentrate on her work. It was difficult because, intermittently, she felt eyes brushing her body, moving across her like searchlight beams, scanning the yard in a prison movie. There were moments when she wanted to scream, moments when she wanted to spin around in her chair and hurl something, but she remained in control of herself and did none of these things. She had survived days of this sort often enough in the past. She would survive this one as well. The weather was good, but today she spent her lunch hour at her desk rather than risk the park. Several times during the afternoon the sensation of being watched was unbearable, and she retreated to the ladies' room. She endured the final hours, a minute at a time, and finally it was 5 o'clock, and she straightened her desk and left. The descent on the elevator was unbearable. She bore it. The bus ride home, the walk from the bus stop to her apartment building, were unendurable. She endured them. In her apartment, with the door locked and bolted, she stripped off her clothes and hurled them into a corner of the room as if they were unclean, as if the day had irrevocably soiled them. She stayed a long while under the shower, washed her hair, blow-dried it, then returned to her bedroom and stood nude before the full-length mirror on the closet door. She studied herself at some length, and intermittently her hands would move to cup a breast or trace a swell of a thigh, not to arouse, but to assess, to chart the dimensions of her physical self. And now, a meal alone, a few hours of the book, a lazy night in front of the television set. She closed her eyes, and at once she felt other eyes upon her, felt them as she had been feeling them all day. She knew that she was alone, that now no one was watching her, but this knowledge did nothing to dispel a feeling. She sighed. She would not, could not stay home tonight. When she left the building, stepping out into the cool of dusk, her appearance was very different. Her tawny hair, which she'd worn pinned up earlier, hung free. Her makeup was overdone, with an excess of mascara and a deep blush of rouge in the hollows of her cheeks. During the day, she'd worn no scent beyond a touch of Jean Nette applied after a morning shower. Now she dashed on an abundance of the perfume she wore only on nights like this one, a strident scent redolent of musk. Her dress was close-fitting and revealing, the skirt slit oriental fashion high on one thigh, the neckline low to display her décolletage. She strode purposely on her high-heeled shoes, her buttocks swaying as she walked. She looked sluttish, and she knew it, and gloried in the knowledge. She checked the mirror carefully before leaving the apartment, and she had liked what she saw. Now walking down the street with her handbag bouncing against her swinging hip, she could feel the heat building up within her flesh. She could also feel the eyes of the men she passed, men who sat on stoops or loitered in doorways, men walking with purpose who stopped for a glance in her direction. But there was a difference. Now she relished those glances. She fed on the heat in those eyes, and the fire within herself burned hotter in response. A car slowed. The driver leaned across the seat, called to her. She missed the words, but felt the touch of his eyes. A pulse throbbed insistently throughout her entire body now. She was frightened of her own feelings, of the real dangers she faced, but at the same time she was alive, gloriously alive, as she had not been in far too long. Before she had walked through the day, now the blood was singing in her veins. She passed several bars before finding the cocktail lounge she wanted. The interior was dimly lit, the floor soft with carpeting. An overactive air conditioner had lowered the temperature to an almost uncomfortable level. She walked bravely into the room. There were several empty tables along the wall, but she passed them by, walking her swivel-hipped walk to the bar and taking a stool at the far end. The cold air was stimulating against her warm skin. The bartender gave her a minute, then ambled over and leaned against the bar in front of her. He looked at once knowing and disinterested, his heavy lids shading his dark brown eyes and giving them a sleepy look. "Stinger," she said. While she was building the drink, she drew her handbag into her lap and groped within it for her billfold. She found a 10 and set it on top of the bar, then fumbled reflectively within her bag for another moment, checking its contents. The bartender placed a drink on the bar in front of her, took her money, returned with her change. She looked at a drink, then at a reflection in the back bar mirror. Men were watching her. She could tell. She could always tell. Their gaze fell on her and warmed the skin where they touched her. Odd, she thought. how the same sensation that had been so disturbing and unpleasant all day long was so desirable and exciting now. She raised a glass, sipped her drink. The combined flavor of cognac and creme de menthe was at once warm and cold upon her lips and tongue. She swallowed, sipped again. "That a stinger?" He was at her elbow, and she flicked her eyes in his direction while continuing to face forward. A small man, stockily built, balding tanned, with a dusting of freckles across his high forehead. He wore a navy blue Kiana shirt, open at the throat, and his dark chest hair was beginning to go gray. "Drink up," he suggested. "Let me buy you another." She turned now, looked levelly at him. He had small eyes. Their whites showed a tracery of blue vein at their outer corners. The irises were a very dark brown, an unreadable color, and the black pupils, hugely dilated in the bar's dim interior, covered most of the irises. "I haven't seen you here," he said, hoisting himself onto the seat beside her. "I usually drop in around this time. Have a couple, see my friends. Not in the neighborhood, are you?" Calculating eyes, she thought, curiously passionless eyes, for all their cool intensity. Worst of all, they were small eyes, almost beady eyes. "I don't want company," she said. "Hey, how do you know you don't like me if you don't give me a chance?" He was grinning, but there was no humor in it. "You don't even know my name, lady. How can you despise a total stranger? Please, leave me alone." "What are you, Greta Garbo?" He got up from his stool, took a half step away from her, gave her a glare and a curled lip. "You want to drink alone?" he said. "Why don't you just buy a bottle and take it home with you? You can take it to bed and suck on it, honey." He had ruined the bar for her. She scooped up her change, left her drink unfinished. Two blocks down and one block over, she found a second cocktail lounge, virtually indistinguishable from the first one. Perhaps the lighting was a little softer, the background music the slightest bit lower in pitch. Again she passed up the rows of tables and seated herself at the bar. Again she ordered a stinger and let it rest on the bar top for a moment before taking the first exquisite sip. Again she felt male eyes upon her, and again they gave her the same hot cold sensation as the combination of brandy and creme de menthe. This time, when a man approached her, she sensed his presence for a long moment before he spoke. She studied him out of the corner of her eye. He was tall and lean, she noted, and there was a self-contained air about him, a sense of considerable self-assurance. She wanted to turn, to look directly into his eyes, but instead she raised her glass to her lips and waited for him to make a move. "You're a few minutes late," he said. She turned, looked at him. There was a weathered, raw-boned look to him that matched the Western-style clothes he wore. The faded chambray shirt, the skin-tight denim jeans. Without glancing down, she knew he'd be wearing boots and that they would be good ones. "I'm late?" He nodded. "I've been waiting for you for close to an hour. Of course, it wasn't until you walked in that I knew it was you I was waiting for, but one look was all it took. My name's Harley." She made up a name. He seemed satisfied with it, using it when he asked her if he could buy her a drink. "I'm not done with this one yet," she said. "Then why don't you just finish it and come for a walk in the moonlight?" "Where would we walk? My apartment's just a block and a half from here." "You don't waste time." "I told you I waited close to an hour for you. I figure the rest of the evening's too precious to waste." She had been unwilling to look directly into his eyes, but she did so now, and she was not disappointed. His eyes were large and well-spaced, blue in color, a light blue of a shade that often struck her as cold and forbidding. But his eyes were anything but cold. On the contrary, they burned with passionate intensity. She knew, looking into them, that he was a dangerous man. He was strong, he was direct, and he was dangerous. She could tell all this in a few seconds, merely by meeting his relentless gaze. Well, that was fine. Danger, after all, was an inextricable part of it. She pushed her glass aside, scooped up her change. "I don't really want the rest of this," she said. "I didn't think you did. I think I know what you really want." "I think you probably do." He took her arm, tucked it under his own. They left the lounge, and on the way out, she could feel the other eyes in her, envious eyes. She drew closer to him and swung her hips so that her buttocks bumped his lean flank. Her purse slapped against her other hip. Then they were out the door and heading down the street. She felt excitement mixed with fear, an emotional combination not unlike her stinger, the fear, like the danger, was part of it. His apartment consisted of two sparsely furnished rooms, three flights up from street level. They walked wordlessly to the bedroom and undressed. She laid her clothes across a wooden chair, set her handbag on the floor at the side of the platform bed. She got into the bed and he joined her and they embraced. He smelled faintly of leather and tobacco and male perspiration, and even with her eyes shut, she could see his blue eyes burning in the darkness. She wasn't surprised when his hands gripped her shoulders and eased her downward on the bed. She had been expecting this and welcomed it. She swung her head, letting her long hair brush across his flat abdomen, and then she moved to accept him. He tangled his fingers in her hair, hurting her in a not unpleasant way. She inhaled his musk as her mouth embraced him, and in her own fashion she matched his strength with strength of her own, teasing, taunting, heightening his passion, and then cooling it down just short of culmination. His breathing grew ragged and muscles worked in his legs and abdomen. At length, he let go of her hair. She moved upward on the bed to join him, and he rolled over onto her back and covered her, his mouth seeking hers, his flesh burying itself in her flesh. She locked her thighs around his hips. He pounded at her loins, hammering her, hurting her with the brute force of his masculinity. How strong he was, and how insistent. Once again, she thought, what a dangerous man he was, and what a dangerous game she was playing. The thought served only to spur her own passion on, to build her fire higher and hotter. She felt her body preparing itself for orgasm, felt the urge growing to abandon herself, to lose control utterly. But a portion of herself remained remote, aloof, and she let her arm hang over the side of the bed and reached for her purse, groped within it, and found the knife. Now she could relax. Now she could give up. Now she could surrender to what she felt. She opened her eyes, stared upward. Her own eyes were closed as he thrust furiously at her. Open your eyes, she urged him silently. Open them, open them. Look at me. And it seemed that his eyes did open to meet hers, even as they climaxed together, even as she centered the knife over his back and plunged it unerringly into his heart. Afterward, in her own apartment, she put his eyes in the box with the others. Death Man by Ed Gorman. The night before he killed the man, Hawes always followed the same ritual. He arrived in town late afternoon, in this case, a chill, shadowy autumn afternoon, found the best hotel, checked in, took a hot bath in a big metal tub, put on a fresh suit so dark it hinted at the ministerial, buffed his black boots till they shone, and then went down to the lobby in search of the best steak in town. Because this was a town he'd worked many times before, he knew just which restaurant to choose, a place called Ma's Gaslight Inn. Ma had died last year of a venereal disease, crazed as hell, her friend said in her last weeks, talking to dead people and drawing crude pictures of her tombstone again and again on the wall next to her deathbed. Dusk and chill rain sent townspeople scurrying for home, the clatter of wagons joining the clop of horses in retreat from the small, prosperous mountain town. Hawes strode the boardwalk alone, a short and burly man, handsome except for his acne-pitted cheeks. Even in his early 40s, his boyhood taint was obvious. Rain dripped in fat silver beads from the overhang as he walked down the boardwalk towards the restaurant. He liked to look in the shop windows when they were closed this way, look at the female things, a lace shawl, a music box with a ballerina dancing atop, a ruby necklace so elegant it looked as if it had been plucked from the fat white neck of a duchess only moments ago. Without quite wanting them to, all these things reminded him of Sarah. 3 years they'd been married until she'd learned his secret, and then she'd been so repelled she invented a reason to visit her mother back in Ohio and never again returned. He was sure she had remarried. He'd received divorce papers several years ago and probably even had children by now. Children and a house with a creak in back had been her most devout wish. He quit looking in the shop windows. He now looked straight ahead. His boot heels were loud against the wet boards. The air smelled cold and clean enough to put life in the lungs of the dead. The player piano grew louder the closer the restaurant got, and then laughter and the clink of glasses. Standing there outside it all, he felt a great loneliness, and now when he thought of Sarah, he was almost happy. having even sad memories were better than no memories at all. He walked quickly to the restaurant door, pushed it open, and went inside. He needed to be with people tonight. He was halfway through his steak dinner, fat pats of butter dripping golden down the thick sides of the meat and potatoes sliced and fried in tasty grease, when the tall man in the gray suit came over. At this time the restaurant was full, low-hanging Rochester lamps casting small pools of light into the ocean of darkness. Tobacco smoke lay a haze over everything, seeming to muffle conversation. An old Negro stood next to the double doors of the kitchen, filling water glasses and handing them to the big hip waitress, hurrying in and out of the doors. The rest of the house was packed with the sort of people you saw in mining towns, wealthy miners and wealthy men who managed the mines for eastern bosses, and then just hard-scrubbed, clean working men with their hard-scrubbed, clean wives out celebrating a birthday or an anniversary at the place where the rich folks dine. "Excuse me." Hawes looked up. "Yes? I was wondering if you remembered me." Hawes looked them over. "I guess." "Good. Then you mind if I sit down?" "You're damn right I do. I'm eating." "But last time you promised that..." Hawes dismissed the man with a wave of a pudgy hand. "Didn't you hear me? I'm eating, and I don't want to be interrupted." "Then, after you're finished eating..." Hawes shrugged. "We'll see. Now get out of here and leave me alone." The man was very young, little more than a kid, 21, 22 at most, and now he seemed to wither under the assault of Hawes' intentional and practiced rudeness. "I'll make sure you're done eating before I bother you again." Hawes said nothing. His head was bent to the task of cutting himself another piece of succulent steak. The tall man went away. "It's me again, Richard Sloan." "So I see." The tall man looked awkward. "You're smoking a cigar?" "So I am." "So I take it you're finished eating?" Hawes almost had to laugh. The son of a bitch looked so young and nervous. They weren't making him tough, though, the way they'd been in the frontier days. "I suppose I am." "Then, may I sit down?" Hawes pointed a finger at an empty chair. The young man sat down. "You know what I want?" He took out a pad and pencil the way any good journalist would. "Same thing you people always want. How it feels after you do it." Hawes smiled. "You mean, do I feel guilty? Do I have nightmares?" The young man looked uncomfortable with Hawes' playful tone. "I guess that's what I mean, yes." Hawes stared at the young man. "You ever seen one, son?" He looked as if he was going to object to son, but then changed his mind. "Two. One when I was a little boy with my uncle, and one last year." "Did you like it?" "I hated it. Scared me. The way people acted, it made me sick. They were celebrating. It was like a party." "Yes, some of them get that way sometimes." Hawes had made a study of it all, so he considered telling Sloan here about Tom Galvin, an Irishman of the 16th century who had personally hanged more than 1,600 men. Galvin believed in giving the crowd a show, especially with men accused of treason. These he not only hanged, but oft-times dismembered them, throwing arms and legs to the crazed onlookers. Some reports had it that some of the crowds actually ate of the bloodied limbs tossed to them. "You ever hanged two at once? The way they did in Nevada last year?" Hawes smirked and shook his head. "Not me, son. I'm not there to put on a show. I'm there to kill a man." He took a drag on a cigar. "I don't want to give my profession a bad name. God knew that executioners, as a group, were unreliable. In 17th century England, the executioner himself was put in jail cell for 8 days preceding the hanging, so officials would know he'd show up on time and sober." "Will you sleep well tonight?" Sloan asked. "Very well, hopefully." "You won't think about tomorrow?" "Not very seriously." "How the man will look?" "No." "How the trap will sound when it opens?" "No." "Or how his eyes will bulge and his tongue will bloat?" Hawes shook his head. "I know what you want, son. You want a speech about the terrible burden of being an executioner." He tapped his chest. "But I don't have it in me." "Then it isn't a burden." "No, son, it isn't. It's just what I do. The way some men milk cows and other men fix buggies, I hang people. It's just that simple." The young man looked disappointed. They always did when Hawes told him this. They wanted melodrama, They wanted regret and remorse in a tortured soul. Haas decided to give him the story about the woman. It wasn't the whole story, of course, but the part he always told was just what newspaper men were looking for. There was a blonde woman once, Haas said. Blonde? So blonde it almost hurt your eyes to look at her hair in the sunlight. It was spun gold. Spun gold. God. And it was my duty to hang her. Oh, shit. The mayor of the town said I'd be hanging a woman, but I never dreamt she'd be so beautiful. Did you hang her anyway? I had to, son. It's my job. Did she cry? She was strong. She didn't cry, and her legs didn't give out when she was climbing the scaffold stairs. You know, I've seen big strapping men just collapse on those stairs and have to be carried all the way up, and some of them foul their pants. I can smell the stench when I'm pulling the white hood over their eyes. But she was strong? Very strong. She walked right over to the trapdoor and stood on top of it and folded her hands very primly in front of her, and then she just waited for me to come over there. What was she guilty of? She'd taken a lover that spring, and when her husband found out, he tried to kill her. But instead, she'd killed him. The jury convicted her of first-degree murder. Doesn't sound like first-degree to me. Me either, son, but I'm the hangman. I'm not the judge. And so you hanged her? I did. Didn't you want to call it off? A part of me did. Did she scream when the door dropped away? She didn't say anything. And her neck snapped right away? I made sure of that, son. I didn't want her to dangle there and strangle the way they sometimes do. So I cinched the knot extra tight. She crossed over right away. You could hear her neck go. This was how many years ago? 10. And obviously you still think about her? It was clear now the angle the young journalist would be taking. Hangman kills beautiful woman, can't get her out of his mind these long years later. His readers would love it. Oh, yes, son, yes, I still think about her. The excitement was plain on the man's young face. This may just have been the best story he'd ever had. He flipped the cover of his pad closed. I really appreciate this. Haas nodded. The young man got up and snatched his derby from the edge of the table and walked to the rear where the press of people and smoke and clatter was overwhelming. Haas took the time for another two drinks and half a Cuban cigar, and then went out into the rain. The house was 3 blocks away, in the opposite direction of the gallows, for which Haas was grateful. A superstitious man, he believed that looking at a gallows the night before would bring bad luck. The man would not die clean, the trap would not open, the rope would mysteriously snap, something. And so he didn't glimpse the gallows until the morning of the execution. Haas came this way often. The town was in the exact center of the 500-mile radius he traveled as an executioner. So he came to this town 3 or 4 times a month, not just when he had somebody to hang there. He always came to Maud's. Maud was the plump, giggling madame who ran the town's only whorehouse. She had an agreement with the sheriff that if she kept her house 1/4 mile away from town, and if she ran her place clean, meaning no drugs or no black whores or no black customers, then the sheriff would leave her alone, meaning, of course, he would keep at bay the zealous German Lutherans who made up the town. Maud gave the lawman money, but not much, and every once in a while he'd sneak up on the back porch where one of the runaway farm girls she employed would offer the sheriff her wet, glistening lips. He could hear the piano player now. Haas could, lonely on the rainy prairie night. He wished he hadn't told that pipsqueak journalist about the blonde woman, because now Haas was thinking about her again, and what really happened that morning. The house was a white 2-story job. In front, 2 horses were tied to a post, and down a ways a buggy dun stood ground-tied. Haas went up to the door and knocked. Maud herself opened it. "Well, for shit's sake, girls, look who's here!" Downstairs there was a parlor, which is where the player piano was, and the girls sat on a couch and you chose them the way you did a cattle livestock auction. Haas always asked for the same one. He looked at the 5 girls sitting there watching him. They were about what you'd expect from a Midwestern prairie whorehouse. Young girls quickly losing their bloom. They drank too much and laughed too loud and weren't always good about keeping themselves clean. That was why he always asked for Lucy. "She's here, Maud?" Maud winked at him. "Just taking a bath." "I see." "Won't be long." She knew his taste. Didn't he want to stay downstairs with the girls and the piano and the 2 cowboys who were giggling about which girls they'd pick? You know, the end room on the hall. Right. Why don't you go up there and wait for her? Good idea. You'll find some bourbon in the drawer. Appreciate it. She winked at him again. Here you're hanging the Parsons boy in the morning. I never know their names. Well, take it from me, sweetie. When he used to come here, he didn't tip with a shit. Anything he gets from you, he's got coming. And then she whooped a laugh and slapped him on the back and said, You just go right up those stairs, sweetie. He nodded, mumbling a thank you, and turned away from her before he had looked directly at the small brown stubs of her teeth. The sight and stench of her mouth had always sickened him. He wondered how many men had lain in this dark room. He wondered how many men had felt this loneliness. He wondered how many men had heard a woman's footsteps coming down the hall and felt fear and shame. Lucy opened the door. She was silhouetted in the flickering hall light. You want me to get a lantern? That's all right. She laughed. Never known a man who likes the dark the way you do. She came in and closed the door behind her. She smelled of soapy bathwater and jasmine. She wasn't pretty, but she kept herself clean, and he appreciated it. Should have just left my clothes off, I guess, she said. After my bath, I mean. He could tell she was nervous. The darkness always made her like this. Wind and rain spattered against the window. The fingers of a dead branch scraped the glass, a curious kind of music. She came over to the bed and stood above him. She took his hand and pressed it lightly against her sex. She was dry and warm. You going to move over? He rolled over so there was room for her. He lay on his back and stared at the ceiling. As usual, when they lay there, Lucy smoked a cigarette. She always hand-rolled two or three before coming to see Hawes, because many times the night consisted of talk and nothing more. You want a drag, she said? No, thanks. How you doing? All right, I guess. Here you're going to hang a man tomorrow? Yes. Next to him, she shuddered, her whole naked, skinny body. Forgive me for saying so, Hawes, but I just don't know how you can do it. You said that before. She laughed again. Yes, I guess I have. They lay there silent for a time, just the wind and the rain pattering the roof, just the occasional glow of her cigarette as she dragged on it, just his own breathing. And the darkness, oh yes, the darkness. You ever read anything by Louisa May Alcott? Lucy asked. No. I'm reading this book by her now. It's real good, Hawes. You should read it sometime. Maybe I will. That was another thing he liked about Lucy. Where most of the girls were ignorant, Lucy had gone through fourth grade before running away and had learned to read. Hawes could carry on a conversation with her, and he appreciated that. Of course, she was older, too, 25 or so, and that also made a difference. They fell into silence again. After a while, he rolled over and kissed her. She said, Just a minute. She stubbed her cigarette out and then rolled back to him, and they got down to it seriously. The fear was there as always. Could he actually do it and do it right without humiliating himself as usual? But tonight he had no trouble. He was good and hard, and he got in with her with no trouble, and she responded as if she really gave a damn about him. And then he came and he collapsed next to her, his breath heaving in the darkness and him feeling pretty damn good about himself as a man again. She didn't say anything for a long time there in the wind and rain and darkness, her naked and moist from where his body had been pressing on her, and her smoking a cigarette again, and then she said, That's why she left you, isn't it? Huh? Your wife. Why she left you? I'm not following you. But he was in fact following her, and he sensed that she was going to say something he didn't want to hear. That time you got drunk up here in the room, she said. Yeah? What about it? You told me about your wife leaving you. So? But you wouldn't tell me why she left you. You just kept saying she had a good reason, I guess. Well, I finally figured out what that reason is. He was silent for a time again, and so was she. Obviously, she could sense that she'd spooked him, and now she was feeling bad about it. I shouldn't have said anything, Hawes. I'm sorry. It's all right. He was feeling the loneliness again. He wanted to cry, but he wasn't a man given to tears. Me and my big fucking mouth, Lucy said, lighting another cigarette. In a flash of flame, he could see her face, soft freckled eyes, the blue of a spring sky. They lay in silence a long time. She said, You mad at me, Hawes? Nope. I'm sorry I said anything. I know. I mean, it doesn't bother me the way you are. I know. It's kind of funny, even. It isn't funny to me. And it hadn't been funny to his wife, Sarah, either. Once she'd figured out the pattern, she'd left him immediately. How'd you figure it out? He asked.
I just started keeping track.
Oh? But I won't tell anybody, I mean, if that's what's bothering you. I appreciate it, you keeping it to yourself, I mean. You can't help the way you are.
No, no, I guess I can't.
He thought of how angry and disgusted his wife Sarah had been when she'd finally figured it, how he was impotent all the time except for the night before hanging. Only then could he become fully a man. The snap of the trapdoor, the snap of the neck, and then extinction. Blackness, utter, eternal blackness, and Haas controlling it all. In the wind and darkness, she said, "You ever think about how it'll be for you personally?"
"How will what be?"
"Death."
"Yeah, I guess so."
"You think there's angels?"
"No."
"You think there's a heaven?"
"No."
"You think there's a God?"
"No."
She took a long drag on her cigarette. "Neither do I, Haas, but I sure wish I did." From down the hall, Haas could hear a man laughing and then a woman joining in. The player piano downstairs was going again.
"Would you just hold me?" Haas said.
"What?"
"Just hold me in your arms."
"Sure."
"Real tight."
"All right." She stubbed out her cigarette and then rolled back to him. She took him in her arms with surprising tenderness and held him to her, her soft breast warm against his chest. And then she said, "Sometimes I think you're my little boy, Haas. You know that?" But Haas wasn't paying attention. He was listening to the chill rain on the dark wind and the lonely frantic laughter down the hall. The wind grew louder then, and Lucy fell silent, just holding him tighter, tighter.